Are you here? You, meaning you the listener, and here being the Paul Leslie R. Well, welcome to episode number 1011, featuring special guest today, Steve Huntington. Long-standing broadcaster Steve Huntington has served as both program director and on-air radio personality. And what a great presence on the airwaves he is. Steve's had quite an experience and added to the enjoyment and interest of people from coast to coast and beyond through terrestrial radio as well as online and satellite radio. For many of you, Steve Huntington is who you think of when Jimmy Buffett's Radio Margaritaville comes to mind. To us, he'll always be the voice of Radio Margaritaville. But of course, that's an opinion. But this should be stressed. To say that Steve Huntington played a big hand in what led to the Paul Leslie Hour is an understatement. You wouldn't likely be tuned in right now if it weren't for Steve Huntington, and that's a fact. This episode features an interview with Steve Huntington, a man with vast knowledge about records and radio, and an exceptional communicator. He's got the voice, but also that human element so vital to good radio. Along with Steve, you'll also hear a little from singer-songwriters and recording artists Peter Mayer and Scott Kirby. Now just keep in mind, folks, the Paul Leslie Hour is made possible by listeners like you. All you do is simply visit www.thepaulleslie.com/support to give to yourself and to others the gift of stories. And now we'll have just a few seconds of radio silence in salute to Steve Huntington. Just take a breath or grab a beverage. Plug in your earbuds. Take a walk. Whatever your style is, just get ready to listen. Here we go.
I think an introduction is in order. Steve Huntington is a bona fide lover of music, both recorded and live, and a radio guy. He's witnessed a lot from Woodstock to the birth of Radio Margaritaville. And it's a great pleasure to have you here with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul. It's my pleasure as well. And gee, I'm sorry it took all these many years, but boy, they were... Now I'll do the introduction. Paul Leslie was one of our very first, what we use the term, guest DJs, for want of a better term. And time after Island Time joined the Radio Margaritaville lineup early in our history. It was way before, it was back when we could do anything we wanted with Jimmy's blessing, Jimmy Buffett. It's how he wanted it to be, and it's how we set it up to be. And, you know, and then I would have to say for that eclecticism, there was a definite peak, and now we're here.
Well, kind of you to do that, Steve.
Kind of you. Oh, and I should mention right off the bat, let's see, DJ Jeff, Andrew Talbert, Jim Hain. What I'm listing is some people who contributed. Oh, and I'm going to leave somebody out, darn it. But people who contributed those shows, which served at least two wonderful purposes, making Radio Margaritaville in those early internet days so diverse, and B, giving me an hour where I didn't have to be on the air. So it was good.
Well, that's an interesting point for people who were listening to Radio Margaritaville back in those days. What would you hear? My goodness, depends on what time you tuned in. You could hear everything from a guy talking about wine. You could hear maybe the Grateful Dead Radio Hour. I remember Little Steven's Underground Garage. How is that for eclecticism?
Yeah, those are some great examples, Paul. It's funny because Little Steven Underground Garage was a perfect example of a show that had syndicated success. And even before it became a satellite channel, as soon as we became a satellite channel, it was, all the affiliates, in Cleveland and Denver and Dallas and LA, whatever, we can't have our syndication success and have it be duplicated by being on a satellite. So that's a step where it came to less diverse, because no longer could Little Steven's Underground Garage be part of Radio Margaritaville. And yes, it was extremely diverse, and there were different things at different times, but I'll proudly say that Carson Cooper and myself, the first two, we would mix it up to the point where in any given 15, 20 minutes, yeah, you'd hear diversity. Yeah, you'd hear Jimmy Buffett, Coral Reefer Band, some stories, some news, if you want to call that. Carson did such great interviews with people all across the land. He called them road trips. And so that was, I was very, very proud of the diversity.
Well, I think most stories are best from the beginning, and I believe that for you, it kind of has a shore or a coastal beginning. It's Oceanport, New Jersey. What, isn't that correct?
Where did you get that offline? The hospital that I was born in is in Oceanport. Ocean Township is what I call my hometown. It's right between Asbury Park, which I don't have to explain too much further. Thank you, Bruce. Right between Asbury Park on the Jersey Shore and Long Branch to the north. And Ocean Township is a wonderful place to grow up. Very close to the beach. I could bicycle to the beach or even walk if I had to, or get my mom to take me and my brothers down to the beach. And boy, nothing like a late afternoon plan where, okay, before Dad comes home from work, we're going to go get sub sandwiches from the store. We're going to go down to the beach and we're going to eat dinner right at the beach. And it's like, yeah. So, and for my getting inspired for what became my career, it was the radio and TV and live concert scene of New York City. The Jersey Shore was pretty cool too, in that I could see shows there. My first one ever was the Beach Boys in 65 at Asbury Park Convention Hall. And in 66, I saw the Rolling Stones, saw a show with the Love and Spoonful. So these are all very important early bands for me. And a friend of mine won a pair of tickets from the New York radio station to see a group at Shea Stadium called the Beatles. And I was, much to the dismay of his two sisters, I was his plus one for that pair of tickets that he won for Beatles at Shea in 66. So, yeah, it was a great place to grow up. And the point being that I was truly inspired by radio, all kinds of radio.
Well, could you put it into words? What do you think it was about radio that was so magnetizing to you?
It was a way to be involved with music, even if you weren't a musician. And that, I'll say, that's first and foremost. I fell in love with the music, all kinds of predominantly rock, but in every other kind. I was just with a friend, we were talking about Brubeck, and I didn't even share this story with them at the dinner table, but when I had a paper route in Oakhurst, New Jersey, I remember using that money to buy Dave Brubeck's greatest hits. I needed to get in my brand new young record collection, Take Five and Blue Rondo a la Turk, both of those songs. And I knew that they were on the album Time Out, but I also knew that the greatest hits had just come out. And there were a few other things on that that I was really curious about. So I went with the greatest hits and, you know, making whatever I made, $5 a week or something, that money went to, well, initially, I have to tell you, Paul, it went to baseball cards. But then soon after that, it kind of morphed into a record habit that I still have. So that inspired me, the music, I would say to a lesser degree, but also really important, was what the DJs were doing. And remember, back at that point, it was all top 40. So some of it was pretty jivey and some of it really connected. And then in, by the late 60s, it became an album rock form. Well, first of all, I have to give a shout out right away to college radio stations and public radio, because early on in the 60s, you could find pockets of shows, late night stuff that would blow your mind. You know, the first time I heard Steppenwolf sing The Pusher, I went, oh my God, I can't believe that this is on the radio. You know, and it was on a college station. So then along came what we called essentially progressive rock. The term freeform got thrown around too. And by the time I went off to school, specifically to study broadcasting to Syracuse University, it was a mover and shaker in the big cities. The one in New York, well, the first one was WOR-FM, but the one that got traction because they changed to top 40 or whatever, but WNEW-FM. And wherever city you were, you know, it really didn't even matter. Some were fans earlier than others, big cities, but they all did eventually come to realize that, oh, there is a form of music that can be played for young people, and I'll say young at heart because you could be any age, and suddenly you could be playing some stuff, some rock and roll that was not on the top 40 stations. And I mean, just think of the big groups at the time. You know, when the Beatles would release a new album, there was no bigger news in the world of music than that. And, you know, by definition, the top 40 stations would play the hit single and maybe the B-side. But, you know, and there were other groups that, of course, were. The Beatles did a pretty good job about putting out stuff that got recognition no matter what walk of life or what radio station was being programmed. But there were others, you know, I mean, when the long version of Inagata Davida came out, not to keep using these these old album examples for you, but when that stuff came out, you know, if there was no radio home in a particular city, there needed to be a radio home. And Jimmy Buffett wasn't too far behind that, let me tell you. He was right there in the early 70s.
I would be very curious to know from you, you've mentioned a number of stations here, but, you know, a moment ago you said Freeform, and that makes me think of DJ Jim Ladd. Who do you think some of the greatest of all time in terms of radio are?
Ooh. Oh, my goodness. Let's see. Because I know a lot of the greatest names, and I'm almost more willing to say radio station names that would have a small assemblage of these people that were very influential to me. But DJs themselves, there was a guy in New York City, Jonathan Schwartz. I mean, I could mention Scott Muni that more people had heard of, but Jonathan Schwartz was more of a theater of the mind kind of person. WBCN in Boston had quite a few of them. Charles Lacordaire did a morning show that had all of New England, as wherever you could get that radio station, had people turning on that every morning. My station, you know, I started out at WAER in Syracuse, as most Syracuse University students did. And I will say, as I have before, that I could have skipped classes for four straight years and still gotten the education that I went there for by being on the radio station and getting involved to the point of, you know, helping to run the radio station and being the music director, the guy who, you know, handled the incoming new releases and listened and cataloged and made them available to everybody. That was just, to me, that's the education I was going for. But then WOUR was the next station over, and I'll mention two people that you'd heard of them if you were in upstate New York, in Utica. Jeff Chard was the program director that brought me and four other people from Syracuse right over to WOUR. It was June 1st of 73. We just had our 50th anniversary marked by a plaque being declared Utica history and being put on the wall of the building, the outside wall right on Genesee Street. That was last June. And so that was a fun moment. And Tom Starr was one of my cohorts on the air staff. And again, not somebody that everybody, listeners, not Jim Ladd, like you just mentioned. People in San Francisco were also that inspiring. The BCN station in Boston that I mentioned, Norm Weiner was the program director and a fine DJ, and he took it over to, he had been at KSAN in San Francisco before that, but he went from BCN to WXRT in Chicago, another legendary radio station, and he led a staff of people to just make radio history as far as I'm concerned, so. So a long answer and probably not the list of known all-stars that you're looking for, but we could go on. I haven't even touched Cleveland and Philadelphia and L.A.
Yeah, it's an interesting point in that now radio is so very much, you know, people are a national presence, but somebody could be a famous DJ in a certain city that everybody loved, and that was just the local flavor. And we've lost that, I think.
I think so, too. You know, I mean, that all comes down to a trend that really took hold in the 90s when corporations started to buy radio stations. And then they really dumbed down at the local level, figuring, oh, we could save some money by not paying this DJ or that program director the salary that they become accustomed to. We'll just do it all from corporate, from national. You know, we'll just flick a switch and have the DJ do the show and have him or her do all the custom little things that would identify the city that they were in, you know, introducing the traffic person or whatever. And so it got much more generic. And then it got worse after that.
Yeah. Well, somebody that definitely had a big part of this story would be Jimmy Buffett. Tell us about the first time you encountered him. What was your first impression?
I do remember being in upstate New York and A1A coming out and thinking and playing Life is Just a Tire Swing. I think I might have been the first one from that I played. And I liked it a lot. You know, anybody who knows the words to that song knows how cool it is. I did not know right at that point how A Pirate Looks at 40 and Others would be the anthems that they became. But then really quickly, before anything else came out, my wife-to-be and I moved to Sarasota, Florida. And the radio station, I can remember either the first or second time I was on the air, I was following a guy who was playing Trying to Reason with Hurricane Season. And as we were listening to it on these great loudspeakers in the studio, he said, "Do you know what water spouts are?" You know, as that line went by in the song. And I said, "No, I have no idea." And he told me what a water spout was. And I soon came to realize that Jimmy Buffett was as important as all of these other artists that we were almost always sure to include. You know, some artists, every show, Beatles, Stones, Led Zeppelin, you know, Joni Mitchell, quite possibly Pink Floyd, a really long list of stuff that you'd always want to play. And then you would mix in some other less across the board popular stuff that was either maybe unique to Florida or the Gulf Coast, or hey, the seeds of trop rock are being born in the mid 70s. So from 75 on, I'm here. And the point with Jimmy is that he knows what radio stations were supporting him from the get-go. He knew, you know, over the years, we knew that too. You know, he would, if in Philadelphia, he would be sure to stop in and see Pierre Robert. In Sarasota, he came to WQSR, nicknamed Quad 102.5, and not only would be very agreeable to being in the studio on the air, even times with the full Coral Reefer Band. It made a crowd, made a little studio pretty crowded, but what fun. And then on the softball field, because they did like to play softball back then. Jimmy broke his leg twice, as he'll sing about. And so, boy, there was one of the games, maybe two, was at the Siesta Key Field, Siesta Key Beach Field. So we're, you know, he was a left-handed hitter. I mean, it would take Babe Ruth to reach the Gulf of Mexico from that home plate, but that wouldn't keep Jimmy from not trying to do it himself. You know, it was a shot out over the bushes between the field and the beach to over right field for a lefty swinger. And so we had a great time. And I went off to Miami Beach, and lo and behold, there's Jimmy Buffett. We had a great time there. It pays that the radio station was about three blocks, maybe four, from Joe's Stone Crab, one of his favorite restaurants, right there on South Miami Beach. And so he, if he didn't have a commitment after some dinner he was having with somebody, I was going to say like Tom Brokaw, or I don't know, whoever. And then he could show up and knock on the window and I'd be on the other side of it on the radio. So that was fun too. So I guess that's the answer to how we, but of course the real point about, especially about him knowing where his pockets of support were in the early days when there were fewer, en route to when there were many, it made it so that radio station was all the more supportive of Jimmy. And by the time Havana Daydreaming came out, you know, which is what, January of 76, it's the follow-up to A1A, you know, we're treating it like it's the new Led Zeppelin album, or more than that even, you know. I mean, it was huge. We would play every cut. We would, you know, and the cream would rise to the top. You know, Havana Daydreaming or Captain and the Kid would get, you know, played even more, and the listeners called for it. So it was that kind of relationship, and it was wonderful.
Well, hearing you list these albums, I'm curious to know, do you have a Buffett album that you think was his finest work?
Oof. In a lot of ways, A1A, already mentioned, is that one. He certainly improved upon it in both production and mass appeal with Changes in Latitudes, Changes in Attitudes. Jumping ahead to the 90s, I particularly like Banana Wind. I particularly like Schoolboy Heart as a favorite latter day, you know, 90s. But boy, he always improved. He always worked his craft. And, you know, I felt like there was not a lyric that he would let out on a final version of a song that he wasn't pretty comfortable with. And it made some really great records.
Absolutely. Now, is there a particular song of Buffett's that you would say has a personal significance to you?
Schoolboy Heart does definitely fill that. I wish I surfed better now that I've said that. I can body surf with the best of them, you know, or I could back in the day. Unfortunately, there aren't waves in the Gulf Coast that you need. And then when there are those good waves, they don't let you out there because it's storm driven. You know, I'll join the happy crowd and say A Pirate Looks at 40 has those personal significances. I never made enough money to buy Miami by selling grass or weed, as they call it now. But, you know, you still just love through every lyric and associate to them.
Is it true that Radio Margaritaville was the first station to go from online to satellite radio and then keep the online component?
Oh, that's a great question, Paul. And I would say you might be right about that. I certainly remember when it was happening that was a point in the bargaining between Margaritaville and Sirius. They had not merged yet, Sirius and XM. And they said, and it was said on our behalf that, oh yeah, we definitely are not going to give up RadioMargaritaville.com. And of course, you know, what could Sirius say? I think they said, okay. Whether it was the actual first, yeah, I think it probably was. What can we remember back in those days? Whether there were any other XM channels or any other Sirius channels that had that were that way. I cannot at the moment. So write into Paul Leslie the podcast and tell us if we're not correct on that, but I think we are.
Yeah, please let us know if you know otherwise. I think I know the answer to this, but who was the very first artist to be played on Radio Margaritaville?
Can I take a guess?
Please do.
Was it Jimmy Buffett? I don't know. You tell me what you think it is.
I don't know why. It's kind of a murky memory, but I thought it was James White, Sonny Jim.
Well, that's very interesting, Paul. Well, to take you back through that history, when Jimmy and I got together to start this radio station, and there were talks as early as 96 and meetings as early as 97, but I was hired on August 15th of 98, and yes, 25 and a half years ago. It started out as programs on Margaritaville.com. And so as you would go to, as you would become aware back in those early internet days, I'll say early because for many people it was, you'd go to Margaritaville.com to find out what you could find out, you know, see if the current Coconut Telegraph was available that way. I want to thank you, Marty Lehman. I want to thank you, Sunshine Smith, and so many others for doing that part of it down there in Key West. But I started with these shows that I would just usually use the title of the first song, like, let's say, One Love. And then after you heard Bob Marley and the Wailers doing One Love, it would be taken musically wherever I would take it, very similar to the full-time radio station. But those first, geez, I don't know, let's say 30 shows all through the fall of 98 and the winter of 98-99, bringing us right up to March 4th. And if you want to use that as the first moment, but it's not yet satellite, it was the live broadcast of Jimmy and the Coral Reefers at the Margaritaville Cafe in Orlando, the grand opening, the official grand opening of the cafe. That was March 4th of 99. And so that makes Jimmy Buffett and the Coral Reefer Band a major first right there for the live show. When we went with Sirius in June of 05, if that's the point where you're talking about as the first, I might be able to look that up, but I'm not sure. But yeah, you make a good point about Sonny Jim being one of the early friends and makers of music, especially when you think about music that wasn't being heard in other places. He was right there for sure.
Definitely. Definitely. You're bringing up something interesting with the live broadcast. I can't think of any artist, especially of the magnitude of size that Jimmy Buffett had, that was doing that, where you could, hey, you're not able to go to the concert in Cincinnati or Boston or wherever. Guess what? You could listen on Radio Margaritaville for free, live. Unprecedented.
I completely agree, and genius on Jimmy's part. And I won't say that it was an easy sell to some of the powers that be, you know, let's just say his management, that might say, well, wait, how, you won't sell as many tickets if you're going to give it away, being on the radio. And that, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but let's just say that his response to that was, don't worry about that. It'll grow. We'll be fine.
So even coming from Radio Margaritaville, there was, you had to be careful sometimes with the management folks.
Oh, not really. You know, I mean, now, but I'm just saying that's such a, as you pointed out, that's such a major first. And it really isn't something that the normal industry would have done any time prior to then. I'll go back to, you know, let's say a given tour where broadcasting a number of shows. My first experience was The Grateful Dead in the early 70s. I was still in Syracuse, and I found out they were doing this, and I wanted to be the one to make sure that the Syracuse show in October of 1971 got on WAER, and it sure did. The night after Rochester and the night before wherever they went next.
Exciting stuff.
It was.
Now, something that I remember very fondly, and I always thought the two of you did such a good job at this. Anytime Buffett would release a new studio album, you would interview him, and it was a track-by-track kind of deal. And some of them, like I can remember the Far Side of the World one, it was just extremely compelling. Steve, what memory do you have from doing those?
Great memories. Yeah, thank you, Paul. The guy's got some stories, doesn't he?
Certainly.
He can, yeah, and in a track-by-track setting, it would bring out stuff you might not have ever heard before and maybe not have ever heard since. It certainly, my memories of each one of those, you know, the Take the Weather With You album, the Buffet Hotel, all of those ones in the early part of the 2000s, great memories, absolutely great memories.
Someone that you were always a champion of, if you were a fan of Peter Mayer, Radio Margaritaville was your source. There was live broadcasts, similar to what we're talking about here, when there was a new album from Peter, you could always count on the Steve Huntington interview. I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about this artist. It seems to me you have a real fondness for him. I remember your wife, Chris, painting this beautiful picture of Peter. Tell us a little bit about that relationship.
What an amazing human being. I mean, if we were all more like Peter, this would be a better world. And what an amazing musician. For those who don't know, I can tell you that the group PM, well, for those who don't know, listen to the Paul Leslie broadcast of Peter Mayer interviews, Roger Guth interviews, the whole band, his band, as well as, you know, Coral Reefers. But in 1987, this group out of St. Louis, PM, which was a trio, Peter Mayer, Jim Mayer, Roger Guth, they had a song called Beast of Paradise. They were signed to Warner Brothers, and it became, amazingly enough, a top 10 hit. In fact, I think both Margaritaville a decade earlier and Piece of Paradise both peaked at the same number on the Billboard Hot 100, number 8. We could look that up. It's close, if not identical. So they had a rosy future, perhaps, as PM, Jay Oliver on keys. They collectively became the Coral Reefer, absorbed into the Coral Reefer band. And so I was so lucky. I was living and working in San Diego at KIFM when the two shows at San Diego State University, the open air theater. So here I am seeing these four new members. And I think that, or three specifically, because Jay didn't continue on after that tour. We did some things with Jimmy. But I think that Peter has said, yeah, that was our first two shows together, which would just make it completely coincidental if that was, I was just All I'm saying is how lucky I am. So Peter is a songwriter and singer with a style that's really not that much like Jimmy Buffett and, you know, handful of others who are in that genre, if you call it a genre, writes incredible songs, a huge student and fan of the Beatles, going all the way back to when he and Jim grew up in India, and an amazing person. All you got to do is see him live, and you are captivated, if you're willing to be. The Stars and Promises concert, well, before it became a whole concert, we did a live broadcast. And remember, we did some live broadcasts pre-satellite with a lot of different artists. Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks come to mind. Tom Rush. Boy, I'm, you know, certainly Club Trini, certainly some other trop rockers, John Frenzy, Sonny Jim, Jim Morris. We did some stuff. And before Stars and Promises became the annual holiday tour for Peter Mayer Group and then Peter Mayer and Company Beyond, it was just a song that was broadcast in a live concert from West Palm Beach. I'm calling that November of 98. And Tina Gullickson was in the house, so she was going to sing certainly with them on it. And by the next year, it was like, well, we have a whole album. Let's do a whole tour. And it's been that way ever since, which is a recommended ticket for you, listener, if you have, if Stars and Promises, Peter Mayer and the gang come near you between Thanksgiving and Christmas, get out and see it.
Have to agree with you there. Absolutely a great show to see and witness. Now, Steve, I have a message for you. This is from Peter Mayer. I hope you can hear it.
Hey, Steve. Peter Mayer here. Somehow you, Paul, me ended up in a tribe together. Don't know how that happened, but we were called by a conch shell through the global village to the coast of Jimmy Buffett's music and way of life. Or maybe it's wave of life. That any tribe needs a heart, mind, and soul. And Steve, you captured all of those elements in being one of the village tribe elders. I don't intend to be ageist, but whose job it is to trace song lines, histories, roads, and rivers on this giant size atlas of how the heck we got here. We welcome the fresh newcomers with their enthusiasm and fun, and welcome the business minds to figure out how all the koozies are going to be made, that we don't survive without the soul of this movement. Like you, who can recall the founding feathers of all this mayhem? That is what you have done wonderfully well, Steve. Your love of music and amazing discographical mind holds our history. So a simple, heartfelt thank you for your friendship, brother, and all the work you do to till and tend the soul of Radio Margaritaville and to keep the party going. I'll talk to you soon.
There you have it.
Wow. Wow, Paul. That's awesome. Thank you. Wow. Thank you, Peter.
Well, it brings a question to mind. There's so many things that you have had the chance to see and also had the chance to share with others. Broadcasting at its best is about sharing, I think. What are you the most grateful for in your life, Steve?
Well put. Let me think about that for a second and mention, before we get any further, that Peter's monthly newsletter, Peter Mayer, Morning Star, named after one of his great songs. Go to petermayer.com, because that kind of stuff, like he just said, not about me, but the way that Peter relates to us all and projects those marvelous words, you don't want to miss it. When Morning Star comes out once a month, you want to be there and read it and see where he is playing, where Brendan Mayer, his son, is playing. So that word about Morning Star. Now, gratuity. Boy, have I got a ton. And it can't really be in any order. I mean, how can you say anything before you say family, wife and family, or spouse and family? The first thing I'll say is, ooh, I'll use a Paul Simon song, Born at the Right Time. Anybody could feel that way, that what they experienced as a younger person, and certainly most importantly in the world of music, what you experienced in your adolescent years is as good as it could possibly be, because that's what I grew up loving. I'm unconvinced that it's that way now. I don't even know that music is the most important of any of the arts, or even, you know, that important to some younger people. But I'm not here to talk about them. I'm here to talk about me, damn it. And boy, am I lucky to have grown up in the era I am. And so right there, for being grateful, I'm grateful to that incredible music that has been made, and finding a career of radio. You know, I think, boy, if I could play my own music, I certainly would have done that. But if I'd ended up, you know, in a hotel lobby, I guess we always used to say a Holiday Inn or something. I don't want to disparage anybody from the 60s right to the Trop Rockers. But if I could have ended up playing stuff night after night and blah, 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 and not getting anywhere, I'm not sure I would have chosen that over what I ended up doing. So I'm very grateful for the career, I guess. Grateful for people who think on the level of how we can all be better people. How can we make this a better world and treat each other better, treat each other how we want to be treated ourselves, as opposed to some of this horse shit that's going on where, you know, just as we're all reading too much of the contrary, and we don't, and I don't really want to see any more of that. have you heard enough stories yet this year about people shooting other people? And boy, I'm grateful to have found a place to where life is beautiful. You know, a sunset into the water is, I'm surprised not everybody lives here, but they're all moving here anyhow. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's up to 1,000 people a day now move to Florida.
Yikes. Well, guess what, folks? It's not that good. It's not the only place. You can go many other places and have it be just as beautiful. I want to recommend that to you.
Well, I always like to end my interviews. I like to give the guest the stage. So I know that there is going to be people who are tuning into this. They came to know you in a lot of different ways. Personally, I remember listening sometimes into the late hours on Radio Margaritaville, where you could hear everything from Peter Mayer to Pat Metheny, and you could hear interesting Irish folk music. And I remember sometimes where I would think, now what was that? Or what a cool segue that was to go from that song to this one. A lot of enjoyment that you've given people, but however anyone found you, through your years of broadcasting on terrestrial, online, satellite radio, what would you say to all the folks who are with us here in closing?
Oh, thank you. Thanks for tuning in. Couldn't have done it without the music. Couldn't have done it without you. It's been a marvelous ride, and to be a part of a kind of radio that would be harder to find right now in, where are we, 2024, than maybe it was 50 years ago. Very lucky to, and very glad that we had that ride together where radio was truly a community. And, you know, you could, boy, if the announcer said, you know, you've never heard this artist before, but they're playing at the club tomorrow night, you know, in whatever city we're in, and then they play you something, you took it seriously. You thought, wow, I that does sound okay. I'd like to be there, you know. So it's just a wonderful experience. And I thank you, Paul Leslie, for letting me have this stage today.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. I hope we get a chance to connect again. I have more questions.
How are you on sequels? Pardon my not knowing, but in your 1,000 shows, how many repeats have you done? Or how often will you do a repeat?
I do it if I think there's stuff that would be exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, Peter is the all-time most visited guest. He's That's been funny. On like four or five, maybe yeah. six times. But yeah, I have people come back for sure.
Great. Well, congratulations to you on hitting that 1,000 number. That's pretty cool.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I should state that it would not have been possible without a beginning. And that beginning was Radio Margaritaville with Program Director Steve Huntington.
Well, thank you, Paul.
My pleasure. All right, Steve, thanks for spending time with us.
All right, great. You can hit that stop right now on the recording. And yeah, that was fun.
Hey, this is singer-songwriter and Little Flock Music recording artist Scott Kirby. I wanted to say a few words about my old friend and radio veteran Steve Huntington, who had a long career in radio before he started working with Radio Margaritaville many years ago. But as I say many times from the stage when I'm on tour, that if it weren't for Steve supporting my music in the early days, getting my song, lucky enough, on the radio, which got so much airplay when that song came out, I probably wouldn't be doing this job now. And of course, I have to thank Jimmy Buffett for starting the radio station. And I had a chance to thank him personally about 6 or 7 years ago when I ran into him at a gig we were doing in New York. But Steve Huntington is a great friend, a total pro, just one of the kindest human beings you'd ever know. And I owe him a great debt of gratitude. So Steve, we'll see you soon.
We thank you and appreciate you dropping in for the Paul Leslie Hour today. You know, you can help the Paul Leslie Hour in our mission to provide independent media content like this by visiting www.thepaulleslie.com/support. We truly thank you. This is your announcer speaking. Performance of The Entertainer intro song and Corina Corina outro song, courtesy of John Premorano. Well, that's it for today. So until next time, be safe and be good.